Almonds, mostly. Some canned stuff the old lady had put up, and a couple of bushels of potatoes.
What happened to them?
George Christopher demanded.
I'm coming to that. Hugo Beck shuddered. I stayed there 3 weeks. Cheryl was pretty sick, but I made them boil all the water, and she came out of it. She was looking pretty good when...
Beck broke off and visibly fought for self-control. There were tears in his eyes.
I really got to like her.
He broke off again. Everyone waited.
We couldn't go anywhere because of Mrs. Horn, Cheryl's grandmother. Mrs. Horn kept telling us to light out, leave before somebody found us, but we couldn't do that.
Beck shrugged.
So they found us. First, a jeep went by. It didn't stop, but the people in it looked tough. We thought we'd make a run for it, but we hadn't got a mile when a truck came up to the house, and people got out of it looking for us. I guess they tracked us, because it wasn't long after that, about 10 people with guns came and grabbed us. They didn't talk to us at all. They just threw Cheryl and me in the truck and drove. I think some of the others moved into the house with Mrs. Horn. From what happened afterwards, I'm sure of it. They wouldn't waste a place like that, and I'm sure now they killed her. But we didn't know that. They took us a few miles in the truck. It was dark by the time we got there. They had campfires. 3 or 4, anyway. I kept asking what was going to happen to us, and they kept telling me to shut up. Finally, one of them told me with his fist, and I didn't say anything else. When we got to the camp, they threw us in with a couple of dozen other people. There were others with guns all around. Some of the people in with us were hurt, covered with blood. Gunshot wounds, stab wounds, broken bones.
Hugo shuddered again.
We were glad we didn't resist. 2 of the hurt ones died while we were waiting. There was barbed wire all around us, and 3 guys with machine guns watching, and all these other people with guns were running around.
Uniforms?
Deke Wilson asked.
Some. One of the guys with a machine gun. A black man with corporal stripes.
Hugo seemed reluctant to talk now. The words came slowly, with effort. Al Hardy looked a question at the senator. He got a nod and turned to Eileen, who stood in the doorway. He tilted his head toward the study, and she left, walking quickly so she wouldn't miss the story.
Cheryl and I got the prisoners to talking, Hugo Beck said. There'd been a war, and these lost. They were farmers. They had a setup like Mr. Wilson's, I think. A bunch of neighbors trying to be left alone.
Where was this? Deke Wilson asked.
I don't know. It doesn't matter. They're not there anymore, Hugo said.
Eileen came in with a half-full glass. She took it to Hugo Beck.
Here.
He drank, looked startled, and drank again, downing half of it.
Thank you. Oh, God, thank you.
The whiskey helped his voice, but it didn't change the haunted look he gave them.
Then the preacher came,
Hugo said.
He came up to the barbed wire and started in. Listen, I was so scared I don't remember everything he said. His name was Henry Armitage, and we were in the hands of the angels of the Lord. He kept talking, sometimes just talked like anybody, sometimes in a sing-song voice with a lot of, "My brethren and ye people of God, hear and believe." We'd all been spared, he said. We'd lived through the end of the world, and we had a purpose in this life. We had to complete the Lord's work. The hammer of God had fallen, and the people of God had a holy mission. The part I really listened to was when he told us we could join up, or we could die. If we joined, we'd get to shoot the ones who didn't join, and then...
Just a minute.
George Christopher's voice was a mixture of interest and incredulity.
Henry Armitage was a preacher on the radio. I used to listen to him. He was a good man. Now you say he's crazy?
Hugo had trouble looking Christopher in the eye, but his voice was firm enough.
Mr. Christopher, he's so far around the bend that he can't see the bend from there.
Listen, people,
you know there were people driven nuts by Hammerfall. Armitage had more reason than most.
He made sense. He always made sense. All right, go on. What drove him nuts, and why would he tell you about it?
Why, it was part of his speech. He told us how he knew the hammer of God was bringing an end to the world. He warned the world as best he could. Radio, television, newspaper.
That part's straight, George said.
And on the last day, he took 50 good friends, not just members of his congregation, but friends and his family, up to the top of a mountain to watch. They saw 3 of the strikes. They went through that weird rain that started with pellets of hot mud and ended like Noah's flood, and Armitage waited for the angels. None of us laughed when he said that. But then it wasn't just the prisoners listening. A lot of the angels of the Lord, they call themselves, were circled around listening. Every so often they'd shout, "Amen," and wave their guns at us. We didn't dare laugh. Armitage waited for the angels to come for his flock. They never came. By and by they went downhill again, looking for safety. They went along the shore of the San Joaquin Sea, and everywhere they saw corpses. Some of Armitage's friends lost hope and died. He was in despair. They found all kinds of horrors, places where the cannibals had been. Some of them got sick. A couple got shot when they tried to go up to a half-submerged school.
"Get on with it," said the senator.
"Yes, sir, I'm trying. The next part's hazy. All this time Armitage was trying to figure out where the hell all the angels had gone, so to speak. Somewhere in his wanderings he got it. Also, Jerry Owen fits in somehow."
"Owen?"
"Yes, this was the group he'd joined. According to Jerry, it was him who put new life into Armitage. I don't know if any of that's true. I do know that just after Jerry hooked up with him, Armitage ran into the cannibal band. And now it's calling itself the New Brotherhood Army, and it's led by the Angels of the Lord."
"And Jerry Owen is their general?"
George Christopher said. He seemed to think that was funny.
"No, sir. I don't know what he is. He's some kind of leader, but I don't think he's all that important. Let me tell this, please. I have to tell somebody."
He lifted the whiskey glass and stared at it.
"This is what Armitage told the cannibals, and this is what he told us."
Hugo gave himself time to think by finishing the whiskey. Hugo was doing fine, Harry thought. He was not going to disgrace Harry.
"The work of Hammerfall is not finished," said Hugo. "God never intended to make an end of mankind. It is God's intent that civilization be destroyed so that man can live again as God intended. In the sweat of his brow he shall eat his bread. No longer shall he pollute the earth and the sea and the air with the garbage of an industrial civilization that leads him further and further from God's way. Certain of us were spared to finish the work done by the hammer of God. And these who were spared for that work are the angels of the Lord. They can do no wrong. Murder and cannibalism are something they do when they must, and it doesn't stain their souls. Armitage urged us to join the angels. Now a couple of 100 people were waving machine guns and shotguns and cleavers and butcher knives, and this one girl was waving a fork, I swear it, the kind of 2-pronged fork that comes with a carving set. And all that was pretty convincing. But Armitage was convincing. Mr. Christopher, you've heard him. He can be damned convincing."
Christopher was silent.
"And the others were shouting, 'Hallelujah!' and 'Amen!' And by God, there was Jerry out there, waving a hatchet and shouting with the rest of them. Jerry had bought it, all of it. I could see it in his eyes. He looked at me like he'd never met me before, like I hadn't let him live on my place for months."
The senator looked up from his throne-like chair. He'd been listening with half-closed eyes. Now he said, "Just a minute, Hugo. Didn't you found the Shire with just this in mind? Natural living, everything organic and self-sufficient, no dominance games and no pollution? Wasn't that just what you were after? Because it sounds like this Armitage wants the same things." The suggestion startled Hugo Beck.
"Oh, no, sir. No. I just had about enough of that before Hammerfall, and afterward.
Senator, we'd never realized just how much modern stuff we had.
Hey, we had 2 microwave ovens, and that goddamn windmill never made enough electricity to keep batteries charged, much less run the microwaves. And after the hammer hit, it blew over in the hurricane. We tried growing the garden with no sprays, just organic fertilizer, and it wasn't humans that ate most of that crop, it was bugs. After that, I wanted to spray, but we didn't. And every damn day somebody had to sit there in the dirt picking bugs off the lettuces. And we had the truck, and a rototiller, and a power mower. We had a hi-fi, and Galadriel's record collection, and strobe lights, and electric guitars. We had a dishwasher and a clothes dryer, and we hung the clothes out to dry because it saved gas. Oh, sure, we washed clothes by hand sometimes, too, but there was always some special occasion when we didn't want to bother. And aspirin, and needles, and pins, and a sewing machine, and a big cast-iron stove made in Maine, for God's sake.
I take it that you did not agree with Armitage then, Senator Jellison said.
No. But I kept my mouth shut and watched Jerry. He seemed important, and I figured if he could join up and get his own hatchet, so could I. Cheryl and I talked about it, in whispers, because they didn't put up with any of us interrupting Armitage, and we agreed we'd join up. I mean, what choice did we have? So we joined. As a matter of fact, all of us joined. That time. Two back down later, at the last.
It seemed that Hugo's throat closed on him. His haunted gaze roamed about the room and found no sympathy. All in a rush, he said,
"First, we have to kill the ones who won't join. We'd have been given knives for that, I think, but I don't know, because everybody joined.
Then we'd stew them.
That we did, because four prisoners were dead from gunshot wounds. A rabbity little guy told us we couldn't use two of them because they didn't look healthy enough. Only the healthy ones. I talked to him later, and—"
Hugo blinked.
"Never mind. There were two big stew pots. We had to do the butchering. Cheryl kept getting sick. I had to help her. They gave us knives, and we cut those people up. And this rabbity doctor inspected everything before it went into the pot. I saw one woman pick up a butcher knife and stand there looking at this bottom half of a dead man, and she threw up, and she ran at a guard, and they shot her, and the rabbity man looked her over, and then we butchered her, too. And all the time the stew was cooking, Armitage kept preaching. He could go for hours without stopping. All the angels said that was a miraculous sign, that a man his age could preach without getting tired. He kept shouting that nothing was forbidden to the angels of the Lord, that our sins were forgiven. And then it was time, and we ate. And one guy got through the butchering all right, but he couldn't eat, and they made us hold him down and cut his throat."
Hugo ran out of breath, and the room was silent. "And you ate," Senator Jellison said.
"I ate."
"You didn't really think you could stay here after that?"
George Christopher spoke almost in kindness. Harry was looking at the women. Eileen was composed, but Harry had not seen her eyes meet Hugo's, not once. But the Soviet cosmonaut was staring at him in naked horror. Harry remembered the way his sister had stared at an enormous spider crawling in the bathtub she had been about to fill. The woman's eyes were wide, and she seemed to be forcing herself back in her chair. She couldn't turn away. "Now notice, the typical capitalist shows certain predictable tendencies under stress, of which murder and cannibalism—" Harry hoped to God nobody looked his way. Nobody else was fighting an urge to laugh. And if it had been Harry up there in front of the table, Harry would have been under the table.
"No, not really," said Hugo. "Not here, not anywhere. That's their power. Once you've eaten human meat, where can you go? You're one of them, then, with the crazy preacher to tell you it's all right. You're an angel of the Lord. You can do no wrong, except if you run, and then you're an apostate."
His voice dropped and became toneless.
"It's their power, and it works.
Cheryl wouldn't leave with me. She was going to turn me in.
She was. She really was. So I killed her. It was the only way I could get out, and I killed her, and I wish I hadn't had to, but what could I do?"
"How long were you with them?" Al Hardy said.
"About 3 weeks. We had another war, and we got more prisoners. It went the same as before, only now I was outside the wire carrying a pistol and shouting hallelujah. We moved north again, toward Mr. Wilson's place, and when I saw Harry, I didn't dare speak to him. But when they let him go...
They let you go, Senator Jellison said.
Yes, sir, but they took my truck, Harry said.
I have a message for you from the angels of the Lord. That's why they let me go. When they caught me, I told them I was your mailman, that I was under your protection, and I showed them that letter you wrote. They laughed, but then Jerry Owen said,
Owen again, Christopher said. I knew we should have killed him.
No, sir, I don't think you should have, Harry said. If it hadn't been for him, I wouldn't be here.
So Owen is one of their leaders, Al Hardy said.
Harry shrugged.
They listen to him, but he doesn't give any orders, or at least I never saw him give any. But he said I'd be the perfect one to bring you a message, and I've got it here. I'd got a couple of miles up the road when Hugo caught up to me, and after he told me what it was like back there, I thought you ought to hear that before you read the letter they sent.
Yes, you've done well, Harry, Jellison said.
Well, George, it was on your orders that Beck was expelled.
Christopher looked stunned by all that he'd heard.
24 hours. Let him stay overnight, and give him 3 meals fit for a man to eat.
I think we ought to read that message before we decide anything, Al Hardy said, and there's a lot more information we need. Hugo, what's their strength? You said 1,000. How good is that estimate?
It's what Jerry Owen said Sergeant Hooker had told him. I think it's about right.
But they've got more.
They've got Bakersfield.
It isn't organized yet, but they own it. And their people are sifting through what's left of the city, looking for weapons and recruits.
So there's more than 1,000.
Yes, I think so. But maybe not all armed, and maybe not recruited all the way.
They will be.
So they could possibly double that strength after they have an initiation ceremony, Hardy said.
We're in trouble.
You mentioned Sergeant Hooker. Who is he?
Beck shrugged.
He's as close to a leader as any they have. A big black army man. Army uniform, anyway. There are generals and like that, but Sergeant Hooker outranks them all. I didn't see him much. He has his own tent, and when he goes anywhere, they drive him in a car with plenty of bodyguards. And Armitage always talks polite to him, as polite as he ever is to anybody.
A black man, George Christopher said.
He looked around at Rick Delante, who had sat silently during Beck's story. Then he looked hurriedly away.
There are other black leaders, Beck said. They spend a lot of time with Hooker. And you never say anything bad about blacks or Chicanos or anybody else. First couple of days, they just slap you for it. Like if a black man says honky or a white dude says nigger. But if you don't learn fast, they figure you're not really converted.
Don't mind me, Rick Delante said. I've got all the equality I ever wanted.
Harvey Randall and Tim Hamner came into the room. They brought folding chairs from the library. Eileen went to Tim and whispered hurriedly, and everyone tried to ignore the growing horror on Hamner's face. Alice Cox brought in lighted kerosene lamps. Their cheery yellow glow seemed out of place.
"Shall I light a fire, Senator?" Alice asked.
"Please. Hugo, did you see their arsenal?"
"Yes, sir. There were a lot of guns, machine guns, and some cannon and mortars."
"I need details," Al Hardy said. "We all do, and things are getting busy around here. It might take more than one day to get all the useful information he has.
Mr. Christopher, could you reconsider?" Christopher looked as if he were going to be ill.
"I don't want him here. He can't stay here."
Hardy shrugged.
"And the governor?"
"Hugo, what do you know about Lieutenant Governor Montrose?"
"Nothing, except he's there," Hugo said. "He stays in officer country, and when he goes anywhere, there's a lot of bodyguards, like Sergeant Hooker. The governor never did talk to us, but we got messages in his name sometimes."
"But who's in control of this group?" Hardy demanded.
"I don't know. I think it's a committee. I never got to talk to the top bosses. Mine was a black woman named Cassie, and she was big, and she was mean, and did she ever believe? The real bosses were Armitage and Sergeant Hooker. The governor, maybe. A black city man named Alim Nassour.
Alim Nassour? I know him, Randall said. We did an interview with him once. A natural leader. Very powerful in the Watts area.
Eileen left Tim and went to kneel next to Randall. As she whispered, Harry watched with curiosity.
Could a TV reporter be shocked?
Yes, definitely. And scared shitless if Harry was any judge. He wasn't the only one. Deke Wilson had been looking sicker and sicker. It wasn't surprising that Deke's territory had been smaller every time Harry went down there. And now the new Brotherhood was at Deke's main area. George looked disgusted. Finally, he said,
I want to throw up every time I look at him. Senator, how much whiskey do you have left? I'll trade you a pint of my cheap stuff for one stiff drink right now.
The trade isn't needed, Jellison said. Eileen, would you bring a bottle, please? I think we could all use a drink. And I gather there's more news. Harry, you mentioned a letter.
Yes, sir.
Perhaps I should read it while we all have a drink. Harry got up and went to the senator's chair. He took an envelope from an inner pocket and gave it to Jellison. The senator opened it carefully and took out several sheets of paper. They were handwritten by someone who'd used a broad nib pen, someone with excellent handwriting. Harry wanted very badly to see what the letters said, but he went back to his seat. Eileen brought in a full bottle of old Fedcal and poured for everyone. No one refused. She filled Hugo Beck's glass, and he gulped it eagerly.
And he'll stay drunk the rest of his life, if he can find booze, Harry thought.
Are they starving or just hungry? Christopher asked.
Not even hungry, Hugo said. Their doctor, the rabbity guy, says they find enough vitamin pills, and I ate well myself.
He saw their faces close up and cried,
No, I only ate human meat twice, at the rituals. Most of what they fed us came from supermarkets, but there were some animals, too. They don't need cannibalism. They only do it when there's new recruits. It's a ritual.
A damned useful ritual, said Harvey Randall. Heads turned toward him. Look at Hugo. They've circumcised his soul. It's a mark on him that anyone can recognize. That's what it feels like, doesn't it, Hugo?
Hugo nodded.
Suppose I told you it isn't visible at all. Hugo looked puzzled. Harvey said, Right. You know it's there.
Some of them like the taste,
Hugo whispered, but they heard him. Deke Wilson spoke in a voice filled with terror.
And I'm next. They're coming for me in 4 days.
Perhaps we can stall them, Jellison looked up from the letter. This is an interesting document. There is a proclamation of authority by Acting Governor Montrose. Then there is a letter to me, inviting me to discuss the terms under which my organization can be integrated into his own. It's politely worded, but quite peremptory, and although he doesn't threaten us directly, there is discussion of unfortunate incidents in which various groups refused to recognize his authority and had to be treated as rebels, Jellison shrugged. But there's no mention of cannibals or angels of the Lord.
You don't mean... Don't you believe me, Senator?
Hugo Beck asked in despair.
I believe you, Jellison said. We all do.
He looked around the room and got nods from the others.
Incidentally, this gives us 2 weeks, and mentions Deke's White River area as well as our own. That may be simply to get Deke off his guard, but it may also mean they've delayed their attack.
I think they won't fight you just yet, Hugo Beck said. They've just found out about another place. I think they'll go there first.
Where? Hardy demanded. Visibly, Hugo considered trying to bargain and decided against it.
The San Joaquin nuclear project. They just found out the plant's still operating. It set them crazy.
Johnny Baker spoke for the first time.
I didn't know there was a nuclear plant in the San Joaquin Valley.
It wasn't online yet, Harvey Randall said. It's still under construction. I think they got it to the testing stage before Hammerfall. There wasn't much publicity because of the environmentalists. The cosmonauts spoke in excited Russian. Baker and Delanty joined in, speaking much more slowly. Then Baker said, "We were looking for an operating power plant. We thought Sacramento might have survived. Where is this San Joaquin plant? We've got to save it."
"Save it?" George Christopher's face was gray. "Can we save ourselves? Damn it, I don't believe it. How could that cannibal army grow so fast?"
"Mohammed," Harvey Randall said.
"What?"
"When Mohammed began, he had 5 followers. In 4 months, he controlled Arabia. In a couple of years, he controlled half the world. And the new Brotherhood has the same kind of growth incentive." Mayor Seitz shook his head.
"Senator, I just don't know. Can we stop that outfit? Maybe we ought to head for the High Sierra while we've got the chance."
There was a long silence. The Magician. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Arthur C. Clarke. Dan Forrester dozed in front of the wood-burning kitchen stove. His feet had been washed and bandaged. He'd taken a shot of insulin, hoping that it was still good, fearing that it wasn't. It was very hard to stay awake. Maureen Jellison and Mrs. Cox fussed over him, bringing him clean clothes, dry clothes, and pouring him hot tea. It was very pleasant to sit and feel safe. He could hear voices from the other room. Dan tried to follow the conversation, but he kept falling asleep, then jerking himself awake. Dan Forrester had spent his life working out the rules of the universe. He had never tried to personalize it. Yet when the hammer fell, a small, bright core of anger had burned in Dan Forrester. He had forgotten that anger, the anger he felt when he first learned what it meant to be a diabetic. The rules of the universe had never favored diabetics. Dan had long since accepted that. Methodically, he set out to survive anyway. Every day he was still alive, tired to death, hiding from cannibals, hungrier every day, fully aware of what was happening to his insulin and to his feet, he had kept moving. The steady warmth of anger had never relaxed, but something within him had relaxed now. Physical comfort and the comfort of friendship let him remember that he was tired and ill, and his feet had turned to broken wood. He fought it because of what he could hear from the next room. Cannibals. New Brotherhood Army. An ultimatum for the Senator. 1,000 men. They've taken Bakersfield, could double their numbers. Dan Forrester sighed deeply. He looked up at Maureen.
"It sounds like a war is coming. Is there a paint store here?"
She frowned down at him. Others had gone mad after less than Dan Forrester had faced.
"Paint store?"
"Yes."
"I think so. There was a Standard Brands at the edge of Porterville. It was flooded, I think."
Dan tried to discipline his thoughts.
"Perhaps they kept things in plastic bags. What about fertilizer? You have that? Ammonia, for instance. They use it for..."
"I know what they use it for," Maureen said.
"Yes, we have some. Not enough for the crops."
Forrester sighed again.
"It may not get to the crops. Or maybe we can use it where we'll be able to grow crops later. Were there many swimming pools? A swimming pool supply store?"
"Yes, there was one of those. It's underwater now."
"How deep?"
She looked at him sharply. He looked terrible, but his eyes were quite sane. He knew what he was asking.
"I don't know. It will be on Al Hardy's maps. Is it important?"
"I think so." He stopped abruptly. He was listening. In the other room they were talking about a nuclear power plant. Forrester stood up. He had to hold on to the chair.
"Would you help me go in there, please?"
His voice was apologetic, but somehow there was no way to refuse him.
"Oh, one more thing. A filling station. I'll need some drums of grease solvent."
Maureen, mystified, helped Forrester down the hall toward the living room.
I don't know. We have a filling station here, but it was very small. There were bigger ones in Porterville, of course, but they were under the dam and were flooded pretty badly. Why, what can you make with all that?
Forrester had reached the living room and went in hanging on Maureen's arm. Johnny Baker stopped talking and stared at him. So did the others.
Sorry to interrupt,
Forrester said. He looked around helplessly for a chair.
Mayor Seitz was nearest to him and got up from the couch. He went back to the library for a folding chair, while Forrester took the mayor's place on the couch.
Forrester blinked rapidly at the others.
I'm sorry, he said again. Did someone ask where the San Joaquin nuclear plant is?
Yes, Al Hardy said. I know it was out there somewhere, but hell, it has to be underwater. It was right in the middle of the valley. It can't be working.
It was on Button Willow Ridge, Forrester said. I looked on a map, and that's about 40 feet higher than the land around it. But I thought it would be flooded too, and I wasn't able to get down to the edge of the San Joaquin Sea because of the cannibals.
Hardy looked thoughtful.
Eileen Hamner hurried out and came back with a map. She spread it on the floor in front of the senator, and he and Hardy stared at it.
Maureen Jellison went across the room and sat on the floor near Johnny Baker. Their hands sought each other and clasped involuntarily.
We have that area about 50 feet underwater, Hal Hardy announced.
Hugo, are you sure the plant's operating?
The Angels think so. As I said, it set them wild.
Why?
Christopher asked.
It's a holy war,
Hugo Beck said.
The Angels of the Lord exist only to destroy the forbidden works of man. What's left of industry? I watched them tear into what was left of a coal-powered station. They didn't use guns or dynamite. They swarmed over it with axes and clubs and hands. It was already wrecked, you understand. It had been flooded. But when they got through, you couldn't tell what it had been. And all the time Armitage was shouting at them to do the work of the Lord. He preaches every night, same theme, destroy the works of man. Then 3 days ago, I think it was 3 days,
Hugo counted on his fingers.
Yeah, 3 days ago, they heard that nuclear plant was still going. I thought Armitage would burst a blood vessel. From that moment on, it was constant. Destroy that citadel of Satan.
Look, nuclear power.
Kind of the epitome of everything the Angels hate, you know? It even had Jerry Owen excited. He used to talk about how they might save a few things. Hydroelectric plants, maybe, if they could be rebuilt without hurting the Earth. But he hated nuclear power plants before Hammerfall.
Do they destroy all technology?
Al Hardy asked.
Hugo Beck shook his head. Sergeant Hooker and his people kept anything they think they can use. Anything that might have military value. But they were all agreed. They didn't want that nuclear plant in the valley. Jerry Owen talked about how he knew ways to wreck it.
We can't let them do that,
Dan Forrester said. He leaned forward and spoke intently. He had forgotten where he was, the long tramp northward, possibly even Hammerfall itself.
We have to save the power plant. We can rebuild a civilization if we have electricity.
He's right. Rick Delante said, it's important.
It's important that we stay alive, too, Senator Jellison said. But we have heard that the new Brotherhood has over 1,000 troops, possibly many more. We can put 500 in the field, and many of them will not be well armed. Few have any training. We will be lucky to save this valley.
Dad, Maureen said, I think Dr. Forrester has some ideas about that. He asked me about... Dan, why did you want to know about grease solvents and swimming pool supply shops? What were you thinking about?
Dan Forrester sighed again.
Maybe I shouldn't suggest it. I had an idea, but you may not like it.
For God's sake, man, Al Hardy said. If you know something that can help us, say it. What?
Well, you've probably already thought of it,
Forrester said.
God damn,
Christopher began. Senator Jellison held up his hand.
Dr. Forrester, believe me, you won't offend us. Please, what did you have in mind?
Forrester shrugged.
Mustard gas. Thermite bombs. Napalm.
and I think we can make nerve gas, but I'm not sure.
There was a long silence. Then Senator Jellison said, low and under his breath, but everybody heard, "I will be dipped in shit." The Expedition. The world must end tonight, and man pass out of sight. But now and then we'll pine for the things that we've left behind. European Ballad, A.D. 1000.
Tim Hamner ate his dinner while Eileen packed clothing into a makeshift backpack. There was a strong, chill wind coming down from the slopes of the Sierra. It blew wispy sleet past the cabin, but failed to find any chinks. Eileen's tiny kerosene lamp gave off a warm glow, and the stove kept the kitchen warm and dry. Tim was relaxed for the moment. He stared into the vent opening of the stove, watching the tiny blue flames curl and rise. "Trouble rather the tiger in his lair," he said. Eileen looked up.
"What?"
"From the introduction of a science fiction story by Gordon Dixon. I don't know if it's a real quote or something Dixon made up. It went, 'Trouble rather the tiger in his lair than the sage among his books. For to you kingdoms and their armies are things mighty and enduring, but to him they are but toys of the moment, to be overturned with the flick of a finger.'"
"Can he really do it?"
Eileen asked. "Forrester. He's a magician. If Forrester says he can make napalm and bombs and mustard gas, he can do it." Tim sighed. "I wish we didn't have to. I was brought up to hate poison gas. Of course, I don't suppose it matters whether it's gas or a bullet. Dead is dead." He reached for his rifle, then took an oily rag from a bag on the table and began wiping the barrel.
"Do you have to go?" Eileen demanded.
"We agreed not to talk about it," Tim said.
"I don't care what we agreed. I don't want you to go.
I don't like the idea much myself," Tim said.
"But what can we do?"
Forrester insisted. "He'll stay here and make terrible weapons to defend the stronghold if we send reinforcements to the power plant." Tim shook his head in admiration. "He's the only man in the world who could blackmail both the senator and George Christopher. You wouldn't think he'd have the nerve, with all those apologies and eye-blinking and everything, but he sure as hell wasn't going to say one word more about weapons until they promised."
"But why you?"
Eileen demanded. She packed a newly knitted pair of socks. The wool had been carded from dog fur. "What else am I good for?" Hamner asked. "You know better than me. You helped Hardy work up the schedules. I can't farm. I'm not as good an engineer as Brad. I don't ride horses well, so I can't go with Christopher's Paul Revere troop. I may as well be part of the suicide squad."
"For God's sake, don't talk like that."
She left off the packing and came over to stand beside him. He patted her belly. "Don't worry. I'll be back if I have to swim," he laughed. "Or pull our famous Flying Dutchman act and drive over the water again. I intend to see our son, or possibly daughter, or twins. You already look somewhat like an inverted question mark." Damn it, he was babbling. The fear was showing through.
"Tim, don't make it harder, Eileen."
"No."
"Well, you're all packed."
Tim punched the button on his watch.
"We have an hour before we leave," he said.
He stood and grabbed her.
"Gotcha." "Tim?"
"Yes." Whatever she had been about to say, she said instead,
"Did you get our reservations at the Savoy?"
"They were all booked up. I found some place closer."
"Goody."
There were a dozen of them, led by Johnny Baker. Three of Deke Wilson's ranchers. Jack Ross, a Christopher brother-in-law. Tim wasn't surprised to see Mark Chescu and Hugo Beck among the volunteers. He recognized most of the others as Valley ranchers. But one man, middle-aged and far too small for his clothes, was a stranger. Tim went over to him and introduced himself. "Jason Gilcuddy," the man said. "I saw your TV programs. Glad to meet you." "Gilcuddy, I've heard that name. Where?" Jason smiled. "From my books, maybe.
More likely you heard it here. Harry and I are both married to Donna. Used to be Donna Adams. Her mother raised pluperfect hell about that.
Oh.
Tim followed Gilcuddy's look to Harry and a slim girl, blonde, not more than 19, standing near Eileen. He pitched his backpack into the truck. The rifle was slung over his shoulder.
How long? He asked.
They're waiting for something, Jason said. I don't know what. No point in standing here. See you.
Jason went over to Harry and the girl. She embraced Gilcuddy while Harry stood watching.
Wonder what Hardy thinks of that, Tim thought. He likes everything neat. And what does it make Jason and Harry? Brothers-in-law? Husbands-in-law? The arrangement made sense, with Harry out on his rounds for weeks at a time. Someone had to work the chicken ranch while Harry was out. Tim found Eileen with Maureen Jellison.
My comet sure plays games with cultural patterns, he said. He inclined his head toward Harry and Jason and Donna.
Eileen took his hand and held tightly.
Hi, Maureen, Tim said. Where's General Baker?
He'll be out in a moment.
Eileen and Maureen and Donna, they all had the same look. Tim had an impulse to laugh, but he didn't. They looked exactly like the women in the old John Wayne movies, when the cavalry troop was about to ride out through the gates. Had they seen the movies, or had John Ford captured a truth? A light truck drove up, and two ranch hands jumped down. Chief Hartman got out of the cab.
"Easy with that," Hartman said. He looked around, then came over to Tim and Maureen. "Where's the general?" he asked.
"Inside."
"Okay. Best more than one knows, anyway. Mr. Hamner, come look. We brought your radio gear."
He pointed to the boxes that the ranchers were loading in with the expedition baggage.
"The set runs off a car battery. That other box contains a beam antenna. You get that to the highest place you can find and point it at us. From the power plant, that's 20 degrees magnetic. Maybe, just maybe, we'll be able to hear you. We'll listen from 5 minutes to until 5 minutes after each hour. Channel 13. And assume the new Brotherhood's listening in. You got all that?"
"Yes," Tim repeated the instructions. Johnny Baker came out of the house. He carried a rifle and wore a pistol on his belt. Maureen went to him and held him possessively. There certainly were a lot of grim faces showing tonight. Tim decided that looking nonchalant was a waste of effort. Mark Chescu looked indecently cheerful, but that fit. Tim had heard him asking Harry the mailman in all innocence,
"What are we calling this? The War of Harry's Truck?"
Mark didn't know why they were fighting and didn't care. Hugo Beck was grimmer than the rest. If the angels got their hands on the apostate, he'd have reason. But maybe he had reason now. Nobody was going near him. Poor bastard.
"What the hell are we waiting on?" Jack Ross demanded. He was built like a Christopher, a massive choleric man. There were 3 fingers missing from his left hand and a scar that ran clear to his elbow, the result of an argument with a harvesting machine. His fine blonde mustache was nearly invisible, a mere token.
"The scouts," Baker said. "It shouldn't be long."
"Yeah, sure."
Rick Delante seemed in a foul mood. He went to Baker, ignoring the others standing by.
"Johnny, I want to go with you."
"No."
"Damn it.
I've explained before," Baker said. He took Delante off to one side. Tim could barely hear their voices. He strained to catch it, eavesdropping or no.
"We can't risk all of the last astronauts," Baker said. "We can't leave one Russian here alone, and Russians wouldn't be any use anyway. This is a diplomatic mission. They might not be welcome."
"Fine, leave them here and take me."
"And who watches out for them, Rick? They're our friends, and we promised. Visit our home, we said. You'll have a native guide, we said. You saw the way some of these farmers reacted. Russians are not popular just now."
"Neither are blacks."
"But you are. You're a space hero here. Rick, we promised them, and we came down in their capsule."
"Fine. You stay. I'll go."
"Damn it, Johnny, that power plant is important." "I know that.
Now just remember where we're going, and tell me what anyone will think if he sees a black man's face from a distance. You can't play ambassador. Shut up and soldier, Colonel Delante.
Rick was silent for a moment. Finally, "Yes, sir. I'd file a protest, but I don't know the Inspector General's address."
Baker clapped Delante on the shoulder, then came back to Tim. If he'd caught him eavesdropping, he didn't mention it.
"They want you inside," he said.
Hamner blinked.
"Right." He went up to the ranch house, still holding Eileen's hand.
The swelling of her pregnancy was just beginning to show, but it threw her balance off, so that she stumbled and had to brace herself against his arm. Jellison, Hardy, and Dan Forrester were in the living room. Forrester thrust papers encased in a Ziploc bag into Tim's hands.
"These are some more ideas I had. General Baker has copies, too, but..."
"Right," Tim said. "If you get a chance, scout out the West Shore," Al Hardy said. "We'd like to know what's going on over there. And there's a list of stuff you might be able to use."
Tim looked at the papers in his hands.
Through the plastic, he could see only the top sheet. It was a list. Iron oxide, found in paint stores, called red pigment, red spall, also found in the rust pile in automobile wrecking yards, or can be scraped from any rusty iron and ground finely. Powdered aluminum, found in paint stores as a pigment. Plaster of Paris. The list was long, and most of the items seemed useless. Tim knew better. He knew that on the other sheets in the stack were the means for turning those common items into deadly weapons. He looked at Forrester.
"I'd hate to have you mad at me."
Forrester looked embarrassed.
"I remember everything I read, and I read a lot."
"Have you ever done any skin diving?" Al Hardy asked.
Strange question.
"Yes?"
"Thought so," Hardy said. "Turns out you and Randall weren't the only ones to think of that idea. The fishing camp down by Porterville salvaged some scuba gear. They're selling it to us along with the boats."
Hardy looked darkly at Forrester.
"This expedition is expensive. You wouldn't believe how expensive. We had to trade for the boats, and they'll use gasoline we don't have enough of. And all those sacks of stuff you're taking with you. Good fertilizer."
"I'm sorry," Forrester said.
"Sure," Hardy said. "Hamner, there are towns out in the valley, underwater. We're hoping either you or Baker will have a chance to do some salvage work. Both of you have scuba experience, but the only wetsuit we could buy turns out to be small. I don't know if Baker can get into it, which means you may have to do the diving. There's another list in that packet of papers Forrester gave you. Stuff we need. But give his first priority."
"And we want information," Senator Jellison said.
He sounded tired, and Tim thought he looked gray, but perhaps it was only the pale yellow kerosene light.
"We've had short radio contact with people on the other side of the San Joaquin Sea," Jellison said. "There were oil fields out there, lots of them, and there seemed to be survivors. They were friendly enough on the radio, but you can never tell. Anyway, find out what you can. Maybe the power plant people know. We can use allies. Baker has authority to make deals. You don't, but you know conditions here better than Johnny does. He'll need your advice."
Tim looked thoughtful. "Everybody has assumed the people at the power plant will be friendly," he said. "What if they're not? I thought my observatory... Anyway, what if they're not?"
"Baker has instructions on that," Jellison said. "Warn them about the cannibals and leave them alone."
"And see what you can salvage out in the valley," Hardy said. "We can't let all this manpower and gasoline go to waste."
A rancher put his head in the door.
"Scouts are back," he said. "It's okay. We have the boats."
Hardy nodded. "All right. Hamner, get your goodbyes said. Now I'll go find out exactly what all this cost us," he said with distaste. He went. Under the black beard, Dan Forrester's lips were a hard, thin line. Forrester didn't always show his anger. It showed now only in the way he fumbled for words before saying, "Giving up the power plant would not turn out to be an optimum solution." "We'll save it. You guard the home front.
Tim went back out into the cold night, 4 hours until dawn. Maureen blinked back tears as the truck drove away. She watched the taillight dwindle and vanish on the highway south, and stood in the cold wind long after she couldn't see it any longer. It all made sense. If they had to send off an expedition, Johnny Baker was the logical man to lead it. People knew who he was. They'd recognize him, or at least know of him, and nobody else in the stronghold qualified that way. George Christopher and the others on horses could move down the east side of the valley, staying up in the hills, looking for ranchers, organized valleys, anyone to recruit for the attack on the cannibals. But no one across the sea would have heard of the Christophers, and everyone knew Johnny Baker. Johnny was a hero. She didn't want to go inside. In there, Al Hardy and Harvey Randall would be working with Dr. Forrester, planning tomorrow's work, locating supplies and chemicals that Forrester could use. Her father might be there, too. She didn't want to see Harv just then, and she didn't want to see her father.
"I'm a goddamn prize in a goddamn contest," she said aloud. "In a goddamn fairy tale. Why doesn't anyone ever speak for the princess?"
She could hardly blame her father for the symmetry of it all, though she was tempted. But it was all so pat, it made so much sense. The stronghold had to have allies. People who might join to fight the cannibals were in the hills, where men could go only on foot or horseback. They would be locals, most of them. It made good sense to send 20 locals into the hills on horseback, led by a local, a farmer, a fine horseman, George Christopher. And the power plant had to be saved, thanks to Forrester's gentle extortion. But cut off from events by the sea around them, how were the defenders to know their friends from their enemies? Best to send a man with some military authority, a man any adult American would recognize in a fog on a moonless night, General Johnny Baker. Which left Harvey Randall free to work with Dr. Forrester, whom he had known in a previous life, on the weapons to defend the stronghold. So the knights were riding off in three directions, and he who came back with the prize, his life, would inherit the princess and half the kingdom. They could all come back. It could happen. But when did the princess ever get her choice? Hello. She didn't turn to look.
He's so damned visible.
Yeah, Harv said. He wondered, but in silence, how the angels who hated the atomic plant so much would feel about the space program. Someone like Jerry Owen would recognize Baker as fast as any power plant operator would. That's why he's there, he said. When she didn't answer, didn't even turn, he went back inside. There were 4 boats for 20 men. 2 were cabin cruisers, small fiberglass boats used in inland lakes, powered by outboards. There was a 20-foot open dory, also with an outboard. And there was the Cindy Lou. She was a bomb. 20 feet long, and only wide enough for 2 people to sit in the tiny cockpit. The rest of the boat was an enormous inboard engine covered with bright chrome. Cindy Lou had lost most of her bright tangerine metallic flake paint. The chrome didn't glow when Johnny Baker played a flashlight across her. She was a nautical drag racer, but she wouldn't go very fast with an oil drum barge hooked behind her and loaded with supplies. "This was quite a find," said Horry Jackson. "We can use her to..." "She's gorgeous. Who cares what she's for?" The fishing camp leader chortled. "Isn't she just... But the senator wanted something that could tow a load, and since I'm coming along, I'd as soon have something fast, just in case we have to run away from anything." "We're not going there to run away," Baker told him. Jackson's grin was wide. He was missing a tooth. "General, I'm going because they hired me. Some of my boys are going because the senator's man said he'd take their women up into that valley and keep 'em there for the winter. I don't know what the last astronaut is doing here." "Don't you care?" Baker demanded. "Isn't it worth saving? It could be the last nuclear power plant on Earth." Jackson shook his head. "General, after what I've seen, I can't think more than a day ahead. And right now, all I know is you're going to feed me a while. I remember..." his brow furrowed.
Seems so long ago. The papers were screaming about how the government was putting an atomic plant right next to us, and if a meltdown happened... I don't remember, but I can't get excited about saving an atomic plant.
Or anything else, Jason Gilcuddy said. Disaster syndrome.
Let's board, Horry Jackson said coldly.
Tim Hamner made his choice. One of the boats had an awning, protection from the drizzle. He sat next to Hugo Beck. The man must have had enough of being avoided. Mark and Gilcuddy boarded the same boat. Horry Jackson took the pilot's chair, then looked around to find that Johnny Baker was in command of Cindy Lou.
"I don't suppose she'll be too fast for an astronaut," he called. "But you won't get so wet under the awning."
Baker laughed.
"What's a little rain to a man in love?"
He activated Cindy Lou with a marrow-freezing, mind-numbing roar. The small fleet moved cautiously out from shore, out into the inland sea. The water was dangerous with treetops, floating debris, telephone poles. Horry Jackson led the way in the cabin boat, going very slowly. The top of a silo marked where a submerged barn must be. He steered wide. He seemed to know exactly where to turn to find the channel among the islands and obstructions. The night was not quite pitch black. A dull glow beyond the drizzle marked where the moon was hidden by the constant cloud cover. Mark fished out corn dodgers and passed them around. They had bags of cornmeal with them, and enough of the round cornmeal cakes to feed them while they crossed the water. Enough until Hugo Beck put one in Horry Jackson's hand.
"Hey!"
Horry cried. He bit it, then stuffed it whole in his mouth and tried to talk around it.
"Dried fish just by my foot. Pass it around. It's all yours. I want as much of these things as you can spare, and all for me."
Mark was stunned.
"Just what is so extra special about corn dodgers?"
Horry got his mouth clear.
"They aren't fish, that's what. Look, for all of me, the whole world is starving except us. We aren't starving. For a couple of months we were. Then all of a sudden there was fish everywhere, but only two kinds, catfish and goldfish. The only problem is cooking them. We..."
"Hold up."
That was Mark.
"You didn't really say goldfish, did you?"
"They look like goldfish, but big. That's what you're eating now. Gary Fisher says goldfish can grow to any size. The catfish were always there, in the streams. You want me to shut up? Pass me that bag of corn dodgers."
They passed Horry the bag. Tim ate with enthusiasm. He hadn't tasted fish in a long time, and it was good, even dried. He wondered why there were suddenly so many fish, then considered how their food supply had exploded. All those dead things floating in the water. It only bothered him for a moment.
"But why goldfish?"
Mark Chescu wondered. Gilcuddy laughed at him.
"Easy to picture. Here's a rising freshwater sea, and here's a living room with a goldfish bowl in it. The water rises, breaks through the picture window, and suddenly the most docile of household pets is whirled out of his cage into the great wide world. Free at last," he cries. Gilcuddy bit into a fillet of goldfish and added, "Freedom has its price, of course." Horry ate corn dodgers in single-minded silence.
Mark rummaged through his pockets and came up with a tiny scrap of cigar. He popped it into his mouth and chewed.
"I would kill for a lucky strike," he said.
"You may well have the opportunity," Jason Gilcuddy said. Mark grinned in the dark.
"I can hope. That's why I volunteered."
"Really?" said Tim.
"Not really. Anything beats breaking rocks."
Jason Gilcuddy laughed at a private thought. "Let's see," he said. "You'd kill for a lucky strike. I suppose you'd maim for a Territon?"
"Right,"
Mark roared approval.
"And shout insults for a Carlton,"
Hugo Beck said. They all laughed, but it died quickly. They were still nervous around Hugo Beck.
"Now you know why I'm here," Mark said. "But why you, Tim?"
Tim shook his head. "It seemed like a good idea at the time. No, forget I said that. It feels like I owe somebody something." The people he'd driven past,
the cops working to unearth a hospital while a tidal wave marched toward them. And Eileen's pregnant. When he didn't go on, Horry Jackson called without looking back.
So?
So I'll have children, don't you see? I'm here, Hugo Beck said, without being asked, because nobody at the Stronghold would look at me. I'm glad you're here, Tim said. If anyone wants to surrender, you tell them what it means. Beck chewed that.
They don't have to know about me, do they?
A look passed among them. Not till they have to, Tim said quickly, and he turned to Jason. You're the one I don't understand. You're Harry's friend. They couldn't possibly make you volunteer. Jason chuckled. No, I'm a genuine volunteer, all right. Had to. You ever read my books? He went on before any of them could answer. Full of the marvels of civilization, what great things science does for us. Now, how could I not volunteer for this crazy mission? Gilcuddy looked out at the dark night and darker water. But there's places I'd rather be. Sure, Tim said. The Savoy Hotel in London, with Eileen. That's what I want.
And Hugo wants the Shire back, Mark said.
No, Hugo Beck's voice was firm. No, I want civilization.
When nobody stopped him, he went on, eagerly.
I want a hot car and some practice talking a cop out of giving me a ticket. I want Gone with the Wind on a non-commercial channel, no interruptions. I want dinner at Montgrenier Restaurant with a woman who can't spell ecology, but she's read the Kama Sutra.
And spotted the mistakes, Mark said.
You knew Montgrenier? Gilcuddy demanded.
Sure. I lived in Tarzana. You've been there?
Mushroom salad, said Gilcuddy.
Bouillabaisse with a chilled Moselle, Tim said. They talked of meals they'd never eaten and now never would.
And I missed most of my chances, Hugo Beck said. I had to start a goddamn commune. Fellows, let me tell you, it doesn't work.
I'd never have guessed, Jason said. Hugo Beck retreated from the irony in Gilcuddy's voice, and the writer said quickly,
Anyway, we carry miracles, I think.
He kicked a large sack that lay in the bottom of the boat.
Will this stuff work?
Forrester says it will, Mark said, especially if you give it a good kick. But we don't have much with us. Hardy bargains hard.
Horry Jackson looked back from his place at the wheel.
Jesus, I'll say he does. I'm here.
The drizzle turned gray and lighter gray. 93 million miles eastward, the sun must be placidly unaffected by the greatest disaster in written history. The boats floated on an endless sea dotted with debris. The corpses of men and animals were gone now. Horry Jackson increased speed, but not by a lot. There were logs and bits of houses, inflated tires, the jetsam of civilization. Treetops showed like rectangular arrays of puffy bushes, but there were single trees, and some were just submerged. Any of that could tear the bottom out of their boat. Hugo Beck called across the boat,
Hey, Mark, what would you do for a silver thin?
Get your hand off my knee and I'll tell you.
Jackson steered by compass through the gloomy dawn. There was no one else on the lake, only the small flotilla. Cindy Lou labored in the rear, a big motor with a tiny boat molded around her, roaring her frustration at the weight she must pull. Horry bellowed above the sound of his own motor.
I'll come back with a boatload of fish, enough to feed everyone in that power plant. What I want in return is enough of those corn things to fill that gunny sack the fish was in. Now, it's not that big a sack.
Tim Hamner peered ahead into the rain. Something ahead. At first he saw an island with rectangular shapes jutting upward, not unusual. But as they got closer, he saw that some of the shapes were cylinders, and big. He looked for motion, human shapes. They had to have heard Cindy Lou's roar. Alim Nassor found Hooker and Jerry Owen in the command post. Maps were spread across the table, and Hooker was moving small cardboard units on them. A voice cut through the fabric wall to thunder in Alim's ear.
for their pride is the pride of the magicians of old, who fought to force all nature to their bidding. But ours is the pride of those who trust in the Lord. Our need is not for the magicians' weapons, but only for the Lord's favor."
Hooker looked up in disgust.
"Crazy bastard."
Alim shrugged. They needed Armitage, and despite the cynical talk they used when Armitage wasn't around, most of them at least partly believed in the preacher's message.
"Well, I got nothing against wrecking the damn power plant," Hooker said. "It's gotta go, I can see that, but it's..."
"Sure, it takes a lot of industry to support something like that,"
Jerry Owen spoke with no idea that he was interrupting.
"If we have that plant, we'll want to use the electricity. First because it's convenient, then because we need it, and then it's too late. Then we'll need all the other industry to keep the nuclear plant running. Industrial society all over again. And that's the end of freedom and brotherhood, because we'll need wage slavery to..."
"I said, I believe you. Just for God's sake, stop with the fucking speeches."
"Then what's the problem?" Owen asked.
"Well, the plant isn't going anywhere, is it? It'll wait till we're ready. The question is when,"
Hooker said.
"Look, when we started off, all we wanted was a place to hide. Like the goddamn senator has. Some place we can defend. Some place ours. Well, we can't do that."
"You gave that up the first time you stewed a man."
"Think I don't know that, motherfucker?"
Hooker's voice had a tightly controlled edge to it.
"So now we're on a roller coaster. We can't stop. We have to keep growing. Take the whole goddamn state. Maybe more. But we sure as hell can't stop now."
He pointed to the map.
"And the Senator's Valley sits right here. We can't go north of that till we take his place. Hell, we can't even hold White River and those hills as long as the Senator's people can come raiding our territory any time they want to. One thing we learned in Nam, you leave the enemy a place to retreat and get organized, what they call a sanctuary, and you cannot beat him. And you know what that senator is doing?"
Hooker ran his finger along the line of hills to the east of the San Joaquin Sea.
"He sent 50 men on horses up in there. They're recruiting on our flanks. Now, I don't know how many there are up in those hills, but if they all get together, they can do us trouble. So, we don't give him a chance to do it. We hit the senator and we do it now, before he gets organized."
"I see," said Jerry Owen. He stroked his blonde beard. "And the Prophet wants us to go after the power plant."
"Right," Hooker said. "Pull the whole army south. You see what that does to us? But how the hell do I talk that crazy bastard into letting me finish off the senator's place before we go after that power plant?"
Owen looked thoughtful. "Maybe you don't. You know, I don't think they'd have more than 50, 60 people in that plant. Not fighting people. They could have a lot more women and kids, but they won't have much of an army. And they're on an island out there. They can't have much food. Not much ammunition. No real defenses." "You saying it will be easy to knock off?" Alim Nassour said.
"How easy?"
Hooker asked.
"How many?"
Jerry shrugged.
"Give me a couple of 100 men, and some of the artillery, mortars. Hit the turbines with mortars, and that finishes the electricity. They can't operate the nuclear reactor without electricity. They need it for the pumps. Hit the turbines, and the whole thing melts down."
"Will it blow up?" Alim asked. The idea excited him and scared him. "Big mushroom cloud. What about fallout? We'd have to get out from under that fast, wouldn't we?" Jerry Owen looked at him with amusement. "Nope. No great white light. No big mushroom cloud. Sorry."
"I'm not sorry," Hooker said. "Once we get that place, can you make me some atom bombs?"
"No."
"You don't know how?"
Hooker showed his disappointment. Owen had been talking like he knew it all. And Owen was offended.
"Nobody does. Look, you can't make atom bombs out of nuclear fuel. Wrong stuff. It wasn't designed for that. Wasn't designed to blow up, either. Hell, we probably won't get a real meltdown. They put safety precautions on their safety precautions."
Alim said, "You guys always said they weren't safe."
"No, of course they're not. But safe compared to what?"
Jerry Owen waved north toward the ruined dam and the drowned city of Bakersfield, cubistic islands rising from a filthy sea.
That was a hydroelectric plant. Was that safe?